Hello and welcome to Power of 10, a show about design operating at many levels of Zoom, from thoughtful detail through to transformation in organizations, society, and the world. My name's Andy Pollane. I'm a design leadership coach, service design and innovation consultant, educator, and writer. My guest today is Peter Meerholtz. We've crossed paths online lots of times and never actually didn't manage to get to chat with each other until a little while ago. He has worked at the intersection of design, technology, and humans for over 25 years. He was co-founder of Adaptive Path, acquired by Capital One in 2014, and he co-wrote Org Design for Design Orgs, still the premier book on building in-house design teams, and one I regularly recommend to coaches. He co-hosts the Finding Our Way podcast, exploring design leadership, along with another Adaptive Path co-founder, Jesse James Garrett. Currently, he's an independent consultant focused on improving the effectiveness of design organizations. And I did not know until now that he coined the word blog. That's a pretty amazing claim to fame. Peter, welcome to Power of 10.
Thank you for having me. Something I don't think I mentioned even in our prep, the Eames movie Powers of 10 was one of the first shorts that I can recall seeing. And when I was a little nerdling in the city of Los Angeles, specifically Santa Monica, I used to go to the Museum of Science and Industry, which had on semi-permanent exhibit the Mathematica exhibit that the Eames had created. And I would just spend hours in there. So feels like some coming back around. Maybe we can just spend our time talking about the work of Charles Eames and how Charles and Ray Eames and how that affects our what we do today.
The origin story for that for me, because I use it all the time to describe that kind of levels of Zoom thing. And it's a very useful thing for design for describing service design and that kind of thinking between a touch point and the big picture and stuff. And I've given a few talks about it and stuff, and that's why the podcast is named after it. But my dad, and I can't find it anymore, actually. I don't know where it's gone. I'm pretty sure my brother has it, but he denies it. My dad had a kind of like a flip book of the different levels of Zoom of the film. And it was ages until I actually saw the final film. But I remember it as a kid and kind of flicking through it. So somehow that kind of seeped in and became the, you know, somehow the thing that has infiltrated
It's a powerful frame. When you talk about layers, then I start thinking, you mentioned my business partner, Jesse James Garrett, who has the elements of user experience with five layers, but essentially trying to operate similarly, like decomposing and recognizing there are different things happening at different levels. We could go to pace layers, Stuart Brand. There's a lot of directions we could take this.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I love all of those for all of those reasons. But before we get on to that, this might be an extra long episode. We'll see how we go. What has been your path from back then? What did you start out doing, and kind of how did you end up here? If you can do the short version.
I ended up here, but even as a child, I mean, I knew I liked computers, but I never really was interested in programming them. I'm old enough to have had an Apple II, and you'd subscribe to those magazines, and they'd have the computer programs you could type in. I never did.
I've done that. There was always a typo.
It was just a lot of work. I'm like, I just want to play with the computer. I want to use the computer. I don't want to tell it what to do. I went to school at UC Berkeley, which is 2 miles from where I'm currently standing now, where I got a degree in anthropology, because that was the most interesting subject that I took in my earlier years, and so decided to major in it. But while I was at Cal, I stayed interested in computers and ended up getting a job in a professor who talked about multimedia and education. So I self-taught in multimedia tools like Macromedia Director and Photoshop. Yeah,
Macromind as it was initially. I'm a director child too.
Yeah, Lingo. I taught myself Lingo.
Lingo.
That I was able to parlay into an internship at a CD-ROM company called Voyager, which was CD-ROM firms. And that's where I got exposed more formally to this idea of kind of working in digital. My next job was at Studio Archetype, which was Clement Mok's design firm. And that was the first time I'd ever been in a formal design context. But I had already been exposed through Voyager to Don Norman. I worked on a CD-ROM of his three books, including most famously The Design of Everyday Things. And so as I was a web developer at a design firm, I ended up taking a night class in user-centered design and pivoted out of web development and into design. A few years later, I co-founded Adaptive Path with some friends who I had met primarily on the conference circuit. We had been in places like South by Southwest together, and then helped grow Adaptive Path for 10 years, where we went from the seven original founders to, at our largest, we were basically 50 people. I left that after 10 years to go in-house. I've been a design executive, most notably at Groupon, when that was still an interesting place to be. And then about 4.5, 5 years ago, I got laid off from a role at a company called Snag a Job, and decided to pursue an independent path, which is what I've been on since then. So currently I am a one-man independent consultant helping design orgs be their most effective. You mentioned org design for design orgs. This came out about 7 or 8 years ago, and that's become my calling card. And I work with a number of different organizations, small tech startups to the world's largest banks and everything in between, helping them figure out how to make design more effective. So I am no longer a designer. I've moved away from design and design practice about 5 years ago when I stopped being a design executive. And instead, I'm essentially a management consultant for design orgs. And that's where I've landed.
You quite specifically kind of said that what I do is thought partnership rather than coaching. Is there a kind of reason behind that?
Yeah. So part of my practice now, there's a few different elements. I do direct consulting. So I embed with companies 10 to 15 hours a week and help them with a variety of things, usually org design related things like career architectures or leadership development or recruiting and hiring. But then another part of my practice is thought partnership. A shorthand for it is it looks like coaching, but acts like consulting. I am not a coach. I am not certified. I am not trained. Yeah. Like Jesse, my podcast partner, is a certified coach, and I know many who are. I do not coach. Coaching is a practice by which the coach helps that person be their best selves and look within to figure out the solution to the problems that they are facing. I call it thought partnership because I am simply I am doing lightweight consulting. So people bring to me their business problems, like I need to reorganize my team, and I will look at their org charts and we'll move things around, and I'll talk about models that I've seen in other contexts. So it's consulting. It's just an hour at a time, usually once every 2 weeks or once a month.
We had a conversation about a few weeks ago. There have been several kind of articles of, like, you know, the death of UX and what's going on with product, and product has killed UX research, or product has killed some form of design in some way. And you've kind of written a little bit about this too. I have opinions about this too. What is your kind of opinion around the, let's put it, the sort of state of the nation in terms of design or kind of digital design? I'm going to say that rather than kind of product. But in the kind of world of product, where product has become this kind of very, very very successful take up by business, very kind of powerful force within a lot of organizations.
It's mixed. There's plenty of good, there's plenty of not so good, and they're intertwined. Yeah. So I've been doing this long enough that when I started in design, first at Studio Archetype and then with Adaptive Path, both of which were consultancies, most people doing design, at least half, you know, around half of the people doing digital product design, were in agencies, right? They weren't in-house.
Yeah.
And most companies didn't touch what we would call UX design at all. It just didn't even occur to them. And so I think something we lose sight of is how pretty much every company now recognizes they need to make some investment in user experience. That is a categorical change over the last 20, 25 years. And I think one for the better, right? A recognition that the experience of the digital products you're delivering warrant paying attention to some degree. We saw one of the reasons I left Adaptive Path, this was around 2011. One of the reasons I left Adaptive Path is we were starting to see the shift of the energy going from agencies to in-house.
Yeah.
Notably tech companies, your at the time Facebooks, Googles, et cetera, ramping up with massive in-house design orgs, new companies coming up that were investing in design. And so we were seeing that shift happen. What we then started to see starting around that time, but I think really taking off five, six years later, so let's say 2016, 2017, is what is sometimes called agile transformation or digital transformations of legacy enterprises, right? So every major bank, every major insurance services firm, all these kinds of companies were, they all had built up these big IT practices because they realized they needed software in order to do banking or to do insurance work. And they built up these big IT practices, but they were operating under archaic, in archaic ways, namely waterfall, the IT department was in service to everyone else. So they'd get tickets and then they'd do something and give it back to the business. It was very slow and bureaucratic. And so what happens is you have this digital/agile transformation starting to occur around that time. And as part of that, these companies started to change how they develop product. And as part of that, you started to see now legacy firms hiring more and more designers because there was this understanding that in order to do Scrum right or scaled agile right, and we'll get to these, you needed design. And so you needed designers. And so you had this wave of like mass hiring of designers inside these enterprises. I was at Capital One, was supporting Capital One in 2016. So they had acquired Adaptive Path, but I wasn't at Adaptive Path any longer. And a couple of years after the acquisition, I did a 6-month project helping them, focusing on recruiting and hiring, where I think, so when they acquired Adaptive Path in 2014, there were 90 designers. By the time I was there in 2016, it was like 300 some.
Yeah,
and they very quickly got to 500 or 600, right? And the reason they had all these designers was they recognized they needed designers to support all these product teams, these Scrum teams.
Yeah.
So there's this massive investment in design, which you would think is a good thing. But, so this is where it gets all squidgy and intertwined. The kind of design work that these teams were looking for their designers to do was basically was basic user interface design.
Yeah.
Right. How can you design wires and mocks fast enough to keep engineering going?
Yeah.
And so you had this, immature awareness and appreciation of design. So you had a lot more designers.
You mean the kind of front end of what design?
Yeah, exactly. So you had all these designers. You had this investment in design, but they were investing in, if you were to use, and I end up using it a fair bit, right? If you're using the double diamond, they were investing all in second diamond design. There was no recognition of the upfront
delivery
stuff.
Yeah.
And so now where we're at today. So where are we at today? This unfortunate trend continues where design has been relegated to production. Mm. And a source of that, there's many sources, but a perceived source of that is that that's what product managers are asking for. And there's this kind of perceived conflict between product management and design. And if you go back to those, that agile and digital transformation, something that I've only recently realized was happening then, was that these companies, these legacy enterprises, didn't know how to transform. They just knew that they needed to. And so they did what they always do, which is they turn to their management or development consultants and say, hey, how do we change our org to be more agile? And if you're McKinsey or BCG or Deloitte, you're never going to say, we don't know. But they didn't. But they, what they did was they looked around, and many of them found some flavor of scaled agile framework or the Spotify squad model, productized that, and sold that into their clients as agile transformations. Now, the issue, there's a number of issues with this. One, none of them actually understood agile. So it was like cargo cult, right? If we're going to just teach you all the ceremonies and these diagrams of it and just do exactly as those say. And so you get this very kind of rote, thoughtless approach to agile and agile development. So that's one problem. Another problem is that if you follow, you know, the Spotify squad religion or the SAFe religion, you need product owners everywhere. Every team of 7 or 8 engineers needs a product owner. And in order to do all the work that these big legacy enterprises have, that literally meant, in some case, thousands of product owners. The problem is there weren't thousands of qualified product people in the world at the time, especially in these companies. And so what they did was they retasked one of three types of roles: program managers, right? People who could organize and distribute work, right? Yeah. Business analysts, people who could try to understand kind of the impact and analyze what was going on, or subject matter experts. And this is the ones that I'm seeing more and more recently, where someone who's been at the company 10, 15 years understands the product well, which means they kind of understand the industry. They've had some interfacing with customers. They understand the details of the product. And so they are now put in charge of the product. The thing is, none of these people, program managers, business analysts, nor subject matter experts, none of them understand the single most important thing we want from a product manager, which is how to run a product development process. Mm. And so that's where you get this butting of heads, where designers show up and they're just told what to build. And when they try to push back and try to introduce process, they're told, no, we figured it out, just follow the requirements. Like, you get this confusion and frustration. And there's people like Melissa Perry and people like Teresa Torres and people like Marty Kagan who have been trying to drive a better understanding of product development processes, things like dual track agile, so product discovery separate from product delivery, and people working 3 or 4 in a box in an equal team, product design and engineering collaborating. Yeah, yeah. But they are, and what they're doing is they are looking at models from Silicon Valley of healthy product environments and trying to teach that to these legacy enterprises. The problem there is these legacy enterprises are just so different in so many ways that you can't simply drop in a model that works at Netflix into, I don't want to name names because I know people at all these places, but into name your big insurance company. I'll say Allstate. I don't know anybody at Allstate right now. You can't just turn Allstate Insurance into Netflix.
Just Acme, that's kind of big what they're
trying to sell. That's what they're trying to sell, and it's ridiculous. Yeah. And so that's led to all this chaos and confusion about how do we build product inside these companies? Because everybody's kind of got a different point of view. Everybody's listening to different thought leaders, and they're all just kind of talking past each other when they're trying to do the work.
I mean, one of the things that I've been thinking about quite a lot, I probably will write something about this actually, is about mediocrity, actually. And part of it is...
Okay.
Part of it is about, it's like pushing a button on a jukebox. Part of it is about the comfort with mediocrity, which I was surprised, a little shocked by. Part of it was also actually kind of about AI, kind of brought it up again for me recently, but also
I have thoughts on mediocrity.
Yeah. But so I was quite surprised when I was in a large consulting company and, is in a design function, and that, you know, obviously that designers really wanted to do the best possible thing, usually, you know, and you know, the classic call outs of, are you just being a kind of prima donna, you know, that's fine. The thing that struck me that I was kind of was from the kind of consulting side, the sort of management consulting side, they were kind of happy with, you know, I would say mediocrity. A lot of times it was good, actually. I think I'm being a bit mean, but not as good as it could be, put it that way. And clients were kind of happy with it too. And I was quite surprised about that until I kind of realized, oh, well, that's because, you know, obviously from the consulting side, they'd sold the thing, they delivered it and kind of next project and line it up and all that stuff. From the client side, then I'm talking about those kind of big enterprise clients normally. Whatever we delivered, even if from our point of view it was sort of 70% of what it could be, was still like twice as good as what they'd had before, because what they had before was so awful. And I sort of come around, I think what the consultants got was, no, well, you get the trust from doing that first bit sort of at 70%, and then we get the permission to do the rest. and it kind of came up with the AI thing because, you know, I obviously, you know, AI is going to have a kind of big impact in some way. But what AI is really actually quite good at is, when I first kind of played with ChatGPT, I was really surprised about how much it sounded like a management consultant. In the, you know, it had that kind of massive learning of this kind of huge database, you know, a knowledge exchange or whatever they call it, their in-house kind of library of stuff, and sort of ingested all of that and was able to kind of spit it out with a massive confidence in a way that sounded kind of very convincing, but it was kind of generally quite shallow, sometimes correct, sometimes completely wrong. And that's what sort of made me think about the management consultant thing. But what I'm constantly amazed by is how good it is at being kind of, you know, mediocre, kind of good, sort of banal, mm-hmm. but mm-hmm. shallow, but, you know, good enough. And obviously yep. then wrapped in that whole kind of alluring sense of, though it feels like it's intelligent because it's in a chat interface, which is a very clever sleight of hand, I think, kind of UX wise. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when you see it kind of generate, you know, design patterns and things like that. So yeah, they're all right. And actually, you know, whether it's Bootstrap or kind of design patterns that are kind of been floating around and design libraries, you know, Figma libraries and all the rest of it, it's sort of pretty easy to make something kind of pretty mediocre. And there's an equivalent in music, actually, which is, if you kind of download something like GarageBand, you can get to a sort of mediocre sounding kind of pop tune really, really quickly because the tech allows you to kind of get there.
Right.
And I kind of think that the danger is there, not that, you know, AI is going to be able to do what an amazing design team can do. It's AI is going to be sort of good enough for lots of people. And I'm wondering mm-hmm. if we should, you know, if we're just being kind of snooting, well, you know, maybe good enough is good enough for people. The thing that I was getting to with the mediocrity is that I think what had happened with, at least my sense is, I mean, I'm seeing it through kind of coaches or kind of particularly having problems. So I've got a very biased sample, is when they are having problems with their product managers, usually, or heads of product, it's because those people are terribly mediocre. And actually when I hear it going well, they, you know, they have really good relationships with their product folks and things are going really well and they have kind of different problems. But it's usually someone, as you said, who hasn't been trained in any of that stuff, that, you know, has come through, maybe has been a project manager or a program manager, you know, and has gone into that role, kind of doesn't really get it. And but at the same time, it's really heavily laced with that kind of dogmatism. And that's, I feel like product might be facing a bit of a reckoning just because it's been very popular and it's been very well paid. And so it has sort of dot-com boom memories of lots of sort of fairly low-grade talent being attracted to that kind of bottom third, and it starts to kind of you know, sour the whole barrel. I don't know what your thoughts are on my little TED talk there.
Mediocrity. So by nature, isn't it that many people in any function are going to be mediocre at that function. I tend to see bell curves everywhere. And in this case, you're going to have, and I've seen this with product people, right? Most product people are, you know, within one standard deviation of mediocrity. And that covers 55 to 60% of product managers types. And there's some who are excellent and they add to things. And then there's some who are terrible and they detract. And that's definitely the way of the world. The thing that designers have real trouble coming to terms with is that you can run a perfectly successful business with perfectly mediocre design much of the time. Not every business can, right? Someone like Apple and the standards that Apple has now set for the, at least say like hardware smartphone market, you need to have, you need to have good design. That is now non-negotiable. That has become part of the plan. But enterprise software, right, where the buyer isn't even the user, and like you have all these kind of factors involved, rarely is the quality of design and user experience a real deciding factor. Occasionally it is, right? You get someone like Slack emerging because it turns out in certain applications that matters. But if you look at like the world of HR software, it's just littered with crap, because that's not how Oracle or Workday or whomever competes, is not on quality of experience.
Well, it's also because the buyers aren't the end users of that, right?
Yeah, as well. That's right. And so one of the challenges that designers face is like, you can make a perfectly rational argument to optimize design for, not say mediocrity, but when you optimize design for return, and where you end up is mediocrity. So I think about this with respect to Amazon. Amazon, famously for 30 years now has been very data driven, very evidence driven. And I was struck a few years ago, I was watching Amazon Prime on one of my streaming devices. And when it launched, the Amazon Prime, the Prime Video launched, and I could tell that that was a raster as opposed to some SVG or other type of file, that they had just taken a smaller image and blown it up. And I'm like, that showed a level of disregard in quality. Like, you know what, we have a bug, just put it in there. If it scales and it looks a little fuzzy, who cares? And then I thought about it. That started having me think about kind of the suite of Amazon tools, because I at the time was using Amazon Music, because we were already on Prime. So let's use Amazon Music instead of Spotify, Prime Video, obviously Amazon Store, you know, the retail experience. And the insight I had is that Amazon invests, and I knew a lot of people inside Amazon, so I've heard things. Amazon invests in design exactly to the point that it continues to get a return and no more. And so they don't, like, they're like, why would we go for excellence when the cost of excellence doesn't return the delta between what it would take to deliver excellence compared to where we are today? And that's just a fact of life. That's the world we live in. Like, you could rail at it, but you might as well yell at a cloud. So mediocrity is a state of play in many organizations. And that becomes something we just have to, we as designers who strive for some degree of excellence, hopefully, right, have to unpack our relationship with this mediocrity reality.
Yeah. You know, there's all that stuff around, you know, design has failed to kind of prove its ROI and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, I don't know that it has. You know, in some respects, the whole kind of design project, if you like, and I guess design thinking, it's kind of been successful because of the way you just said, which is, oh, there's a lot more designers and design teams in large enterprises and organizations where there never was. So in a sense, it kind of worked. And now, of course, there's lots of people being fired. My guess is that design has been successful enough that, you know, in a lot of organizations, they have a design system set up, but they have a kind of, there's a lot of the, they've broken the back of a lot of the kind of design stuff they needed to do in their, you know, whatever transformation they were going through. And I'm a big believer. You wrote a book about this, so tell me if you think otherwise. But, you know, when we talk about organizations, we talk about them as if they have a kind of personality and as if they have a, but, you know, it's made up of people. And so there's this constant sort of degradation of memory going on because people leave, right? Or they move to other departments. So I wrote a piece about some organizational amnesia. It's like they're constantly having Alzheimer's, right? And so I think I'm wondering if part of what's happening here, quite apart from just sort of capitalism, that, you know, those organizations have fired lots of people and the market has rewarded them, so they're going to do some more of it, that design has kind of actually got them to a certain point, and now new people come in and go, why do we need these guys? We've got all of this stuff here. It's all working fine. And I'm wondering whether there's going to be a moment in, you know, a few years' time where all that stuff starts to sort of fall apart, or they get behind again, and they'll just go through yet another kind of transformation, whether it's just sort of that kind of cycle going on.
A bunch of thoughts. Starting with our industry, and maybe concentric circles out, I'll see where this goes. My first thought is designers and design leaders have been suboptimal advocates for design in business contexts, right? They haven't known how to connect the work of their teams to that which the business values. And so because of that, they are often seen as not credible, or just there to produce kind of on behalf of the business, but not to really contribute. There are design leaders who are making those connections and are making change. And I just saw on stage last week at this Design Leadership Summit, Karen Hansen, who's at Chase. She's taken a team from 350, and it's going to be close to 1,000, if not over 1,000 soon. Daniela Giorgia just left PayPal and is at Capital One and is growing a team there. Rachel Kobetz just took that role at PayPal and is growing a team there. Like, there's a cadre of design leaders who know how to talk that talk, and they are showing that, yeah, that with the right advocacy, you can continue to elevate and evolve design, but most design leaders are ill-equipped in that regard. But there was another thread that I wanted to unpack. I'm trying to remember.
I was talking about this, whether it's going to kind of, design has been sort of actually been successful, and whether there's a sort of cycle where a bunch of people, that you know, as those people get fired, whether it's going to come back and they're going to go, oh, you know, does anyone know how to turn this thing on?
Yeah, well, organizational memory, you mentioned that, and that's something I think a lot about. That's what I was going to go to. Something that it's going to take about 5, if not 10 years to figure out the impact of, is the fact that this design inflation, and I mean that that
Hyper-Cambrian explosion.
Yeah, exactly. Like what happened at the earliest stages of the universe, right? You went whoosh, right? This design inflation, which started, and I can remember in 2007, 2008, at Adaptive Path, when we were not able to compete with Google at the time. This is in the Bay Area, because they could just pay literally 50% more to candidates than we could afford for the same kind of caliber. Well, it's also 2008, 2009 with the financial crisis. For 15 years, from about 2008-9 through to 2022, with a blip here or there, we had 0% interest rates. And when you have 0% interest rates, you have a lot of businesses with access to free money. And design happens to have inflated during that period of time, as did product and engineering and these other functions. And I think, you know, when you mentioned, you used the word reckoning when talking about product management, because I do think there's going to be a reckoning probably of all sorts. I mean, it's not going to be. We're going through it. That's what all these layoffs are.
Yeah.
But I think we're still coming to grips with what the impact. It's going to take 2 or 3 years to work through this false, unsustainable environment that we all just happen to get caught up in for 15 years, and in which we level set, but we were level setting in an environment that was deeply irrational. And now that the environment is getting more rational, it's also getting frustrating. It's disheartening with things like layoffs and all that kind of stuff. I don't mean to dismiss it, but we need to realize, like, the gravy days were a product of insanity. And so these less gravy days, the reverse of the gravy days, are, you know, going to be what happens when the hangover sets in. I actually want to touch on one thing, though, given our shared age and what I see as responsibility to the community, which is around this institutional memory. Mm-hmm. Yes, companies, they're all ships of Theseus changing every 3 to 5 years. So with things like design, you know, new people come in, have to understand what it means, they leave, like, and so design can be hard. It can be hard for design to get traction in an environment where there's so much change. But for me, my bigger concern is that we as a design industry have done a terrible job maintaining our professional history, our professional knowledge and understanding. There is no credible professional association for design, for digital product design. The closest you get is IXDA, which is fine, but it's mostly a social club, right? Yeah. They're not really doing advocacy for interaction design at the government level or whatever. There's no library of amazing kind of IXDA journals that we can turn to look back on. You do have CHI, but CHI is very academic and feels awfully irrelevant. You've got, I'm assuming you're part of the Service Design Network, and you've got things like Touchpoint. And I think they're doing a really good job, but for a very niche,
very
audience.
Narrow. Yeah.
And so when I think about the lack of institutional memory, this is a conversation I have with some other old heads, is like every 3 to 5 years, people learn what we've known for 20 years, but never been codified, has never been articulated, is not part of any curriculum. And so everybody's relearning this stuff over and over again. And I think that has as much to do with design's two steps forward, two steps back, three steps forward, two steps back, as anything else, is our own just lack of professional knowledge.
It's been very ephemeral, I think. And, you mentioned the CD-ROM stuff, the Voyager stuff before. I don't know about you. I keep some really old kind of Mac laptops around because I can actually look at the old work I did, right? Because there's no other, those old CD-ROMs and anti-ROM and stuff, I can't view it otherwise on any other thing. And, I definitely noticed when the sort of CD-ROM boom and then kind of a kiosk thing happened in multimedia. This is like real kind of kids go in my day. But, you know, there was definitely a thing where when the internet happened, for a while there was stuff going on. And then there was a kind of the sort of dot-com boom. You know, if it wasn't online, it didn't exist. And so there was that whole kind of institutional memory of all that kind of interaction design and UX that we learned then. And then you had the dot-com bust where, people would go to work and there were bailiffs in front of the door and they'd been logged out of the system. So they lost all of their work because they didn't steal it as they should have done to make a copy of their work, you know? And so there was a whole kind of library of work that kind of got lost as well. And then I think it has got kind of funneled into look at, there's so many websites and they all look the same and all the loads of apps that all look the same and the kind of design patterns. And that's what I mean and I think there is a reasonable thing there around, there's been such a emphasis on velocity and speed, regardless of whether you're a startup or a kind of established organization or company, a sort of legacy thing, that it's meant that people kind of just churning through. And one of the things I think, the way software leaves its imprint, I think John Maeder once said that Adobe back then, Adobe was the world's art director, now it's kind of Figma, right? That you know, so the tools always leave their mark. And one of the things is when people are going really fast, they'll lean into what the tool does easily, right? And not, mm-hmm. and obviously not sort of bend themselves out of shape trying to do something that's difficult because they don't have time. Right. And so I think one of the things that then happens is everything starts to look the same as well. And I feel that, yeah, there is a kind of bit of institutional memory. And I think design has done, you know, compared to the sciences, for example, I think design has done a terrible job of
not just in the industry.
I mean, in sort of public discourse, right? I would wager most people have a better idea of how films get made than how design gets done, right? You know, there's a kind of script, and then there's a storyboard, and then they shoot some stuff, and then they edit it, and they do some sort of post production. I think most people, you know, would get that. I think people would be a lot harder pushed to understand that. I don't know why we're at a point now where
design for software literally touches almost every human.
Yeah.
it's this has gotten way too important, and I'm not signing up to be the industry archivist or memory keeper or whatnot. But it is until we take seriously kind of stewardship of our intellectual foundations, understanding, developments, etc. We as an industry are going to just kind of keep, we're just going to stay on a hamster wheel. We're not going to make progress. We're just going to keep doing the same thing over and over again. I sit in these design reviews for some of my clients, and they're doing onboarding flows for like signing up for an account that look identical to stuff we did 20 years ago.
I've seen, and I'm just like, how
are we getting paid to do this? Now, it's one thing if you're getting, you know, I'm sitting in a building, right? So people build buildings all the time. People are paid to build buildings, but you have codes and regulations and stuff that everybody knows what to do. So it's fairly perfunctory and straightforward how to create a building.
Yeah, yeah.
Most of the time.
People know that a door is the thing to get from one room to the next.
Right, and you have to have certain widths and tolerances and heights and supports and all that kind of stuff is well understood. That should be true in our industry as well, and it's not.
It's funny, isn't it? Because given the origins of pretty much kind of digital, human-computer interface out of ergonomics, where that really was a thing, or it still is a thing, you know, of a code of, you know, this is how human beings interact with stuff in the world. We really kind of lost our way. What would that look like, do you think? I mean, I know you're not signing up to be the guardian of the design library, the world's design library, but what do you think it would look like, but apart from sort of professional bodies or accreditation?
Well, I think we need that. I've been reflecting on this a fair bit recently. One of the themes or memes that's been happening for the last few years is how nobody can hire junior design. Nobody wants to hire junior designers. It's hard for entry level folks in order to get
junior designer with three years of experience or something.
Exactly. It's hard to get established. But the issue then that I see, I mentioned these onboarding flows, you end up hiring senior and lead level designers, and they're doing onboarding flows because they're the only people around. And that doesn't make sense either. And so a thought I've been starting to socialize is this, I think we need to turn UI design for, let's go very basic to start with, like visual UI design for software.
Yeah.
We need to turn that into a trade, like plumbing, like being an electrician, like being a contractor, a builder, where you can go get a two-year degree in the United States. You could go get a two-year degree at a community college in UI design and come out of that like being hireable at any number of companies. And your job will be like onboarding flows and that other very just basic UI interface design that... We just need truckloads of people doing in all these different contexts. In order for that to make sense, though, you then need a body of work that they are learning from that is codes, right? And is akin to architectural codes of like, this is how you, you know, this is an acceptable workflow. You need to, people have to understand human information processing. There's going to be things around whether it's accessibility or all the, you know, those types of concerns, all of that kind of coming into play. And so you need a body of
examples,
design, right? Like, yeah. Design understanding, design repositories, etc., that are essentially, I mean, I'm assuming this would be kind of ISO standard type stuff,
where this isn't Dribbble, right?
Yeah, exactly, right? Where basically what you are learning is how to design to these codes, so that after 2 years or however long, maybe it's 3 years, maybe it's 4 years, I don't know how complex it would be, you can then say, I am a credible, like, you can just throw me at basic software problems, and I am licensed or certified, or I have the credentials to do it. And because you've one of the things I hope for in something like this is that you can start attracting a much more broad and diverse set of people doing this work. Yeah. Because you lower the bar to, you don't have to go to a fancy design school and spend $50,000-$60,000 a year. Right. And you're giving people a leg up into this industry where, yeah, you do that for 2 to 5 years. And then, yeah, maybe you'll graduate into a different kind of, you know, what we would think of as a more kind of on the path to strategic design type of role. But because, and part of the reason this keeps coming up too, is I work with design leaders who are realizing they need people to do that production level work, and they don't know how to solve that problem besides offshoring.
Right. Yeah.
And that's a solution. It's a pain in the ass, though, for a lot of folks, you know, to manage a team 9 to 12 time zones away and all that kind of stuff. They'd rather have people more at hand that they can work with. Anyway, that's a thought.
So it's funny you should say this, because one of the things when I was thinking about that mediocrity thing, and, you know, I'm doing that classic thing of writing an article in my head by talking about it to people, is was the Boeing disaster recently? Because I made the connection, and because you said the trades, I made the connection to manufacturing, really, you know, and that thing where I was saying, you know, it's got to a point, and it all seems fine. So, and then, you know, so why do we need all these people? And then the kind of cost cutting will start, or you offshore it. And then there's this gradual kind of, crumbling of the kind of edifice that there was there. But it's sort of not noticeable for a while. And then at some point you have this moment of like, why are we creating all this kind of shabby thing? I don't know if you know if you read it on the Boeing stuff, but, you know, a lot of it was, you know, Boeing's been very anti-union, and so a lot of stuff's gone offshore.
They went from being an engineering-driven, engineering-centered culture to an MBA-centered culture.
Yeah, right. That guy, I can't remember his name, but said, you know, it wanted to change it from a great engineering company into and run it like a business. I thought, like, okay. but, you know, and then or a lot
even
of
though
the
it had
saying,
been a
you know,
perfectly the, good business for a long time, right, exactly, it hadn't been a financial instrument.
Yeah, exactly.
It had just been a good business.
Yeah. And so, you know, and a lot of the folks at the engineers at Boeing saying, well, we offshore all that, we lost our institutional memory, right? Because literally, you know, we let it walk out the door, and then it kind of, or we, you know, outsourced it. And that's what made me think, you know, wonder if there's a kind of similar thing there. You know, I live in Germany where apprenticeships are still really a thing. So if I get someone to come and paint my house, this is someone, you know, so you someone who's done several years of being a what's called a Malermeister, to become a Malermeister, it's like a painter who really knows how to do quite a lot of stuff. Part of that's also running a business, but they also, you know, they know their craft incredibly well. And when I did renovate my house, I learned so much from those tradesmen because they were really, really good. And with it comes this thing, because I was thinking, as you're saying, I can imagine lots of designers thinking, well, that doesn't sound very glamorous. But actually, one of the things I really like
design is about glamour.
There is less of that kind of class thing, you know. In the UK, if you say, well, you know, I work as a plumber or a painter, there's definitely a kind of class thing that immediately kicks in. I kind of think there is in America too. But it's not like it doesn't exist here, because there is definitely, you know, are you doctor, professor, so-and-so, but it, But a lot of the kind of trades, they're very sort of socially, that sounds really terrible, sort of socially acceptable. They're not looked down upon in the same way. You recognize, well, they're valued. That's the word. Yeah, that's the word.
And it's valued, not blue collar versus white collar, or at least not as much.
No, not so much. I mean, it's obviously there, but much less. And, you know, it makes a difference because then people you get to do that stuff are really, really good. You know, and
they're really good. And, you know, there's tons of people who are doing, I don't know, telesales would die to be able to do the unglamorous design that, if you went to RISD or, you know, choose your European design school. I don't know them as well, but, you know, RCA and, you know, in the UK or whatever, like, they couldn't be bothered with certain things, but there's folks who are like, sign me up. That's way more interesting and better than, you know, trying to sell cell phone plans, which is the only other job I can find.
There's a thing down the other end, though, I think in leadership, you know, and this comes up all the time in coaching, obviously, which is, you know, you've talked about this whole thing of kind of managing downwards, sideways and upwards and how the percentages of that change. And I think it's fair enough for people to say, you know, I really hate all that stakeholder management stuff. I hate kind of all the sort of admin of management. I don't want to do that. And I think there's no, I don't want to shame anyone. I think there's no shame in saying, you know, principles where I want to go, or I don't want to go high. I just don't want to do that stuff. I really want to focus on my craft. I think that's okay. And sure. I think actually what you just described would give a better pathway to that, of someone being really, really, really kind of high at their craft and then being the kind of mentor for other people. But on the other side, there's also the kind of, you know, you can't get away from stakeholder management and wrangling and, you know, interacting and all that stuff is part of the leadership role, right?
Well, I mean, you know, part of something I reflected on recently I attended this Design Leadership Summit in Toronto last week, and this came up is design is still taught as if the people who graduate from a design program are going to work at an agency, right? And are going to work in a context where they can really focus on the craft and they can focus on process and methodology, and that excellence will be what is rewarded. Whereas in the United States, at least 95, maybe more percent of people graduating from these programs are working in-house. Where half the job of any function at a company, not just design, half the job is stakeholder management. It's relationships with other people and navigating this space. And designers are just not even ill-equipped. They are unequipped to handle that reality. It's getting to the point where I'm like, they shouldn't teach digital. I don't think they should teach things like UX and digital product design and designs and like design at art schools. Like they should just remove that from that program because they're setting those people up for pain. It should only be taught at like business schools or in engineering programs or somewhere where there's some recognition of the reality of the work that you are going to be doing.
I'm very proud to say I teach a master's of service design in Switzerland, in Luzern. And there we have in that a whole suite of courses, you might call them modules, depending on where you come from, that are called Leading Conversations. And it's basically kind of all that. And it was exactly that thing of kind of, this is the stuff you don't normally get taught in design school.
And service design, if you didn't do that, you wouldn't be credible, because the only way for service design to be realized is through the manipulation of the organization.
So look, yeah, I feel like I should be saying thank you for listening to two old guys go on about the problem with design. But it's been fascinating and very insightful. We are hitting time. So there's one final question. As you know, the show is named after this The Powers of 10 film by Rand Charles Eames and the kind of things at different Zoom levels. The question is, what one small thing is either overlooked or should be redesigned or could be redesigned that would have an outsized effect on the world?
My problem is I want to say democracy, which is not a small thing.
Not a small thing, no.
But maybe there's something, so it's not quite the right It's a different way in. I'm assuming you're familiar with Dan Hill.
Yeah, he's great.
So I saw a talk he gave recently. He's now in Australia working, I think, in a kind of quasi-governmental or NGO capacity there, after having worked at these, like, he worked at AirUp, but then he also worked in these, like, innovation centers in places in Europe that had this kind of government purchase. Thing that I took away from his talk, more than anything else, is the most important thing that he designed was not the final product. So this was like urban planning stuff. And I remember there was a kiosk in a park, you know, for selling certain items. It doesn't matter. Those details don't matter. Or being able to sell, actually being able to sell kind of out of your home, right?
Yeah.
The most impactful thing was not the end product, this new designed experience. It was that they changed the code, the regulatory code, to enable new kinds of designs to exist.
Yeah.
That were going to be more citizen-centered and friendly, right? But this recognition, as he went through his design process, that the problem wasn't citizen experience out there in the world. The problem was the process by which we arrive at that had these bugs, at least in terms of what they wanted to be able to, the impact they wanted to be able to have, and to recognize, like, we need to focus on how communities, how societies enable or disable certain decision making. And so kind of shifting that focus, if there wasn't a real applied focus from a design lens on these types of processes, you know, civic design types of stuff.
Yeah.
I think you could have an outsized impact for fairly, there's still a lot of politicking and work to go through, but fairly little, like, effort or kind of cognitive effort. You just need to change that, like, lens and layer at which you're focusing. And instead of focusing on that end product, focus on the system. And just a couple little pieces in the system that will allow the end product that you want to emerge.
Yeah, right. Very good. We've sort of talked around architecture quite a lot actually today, and I think there's probably quite a lot to learn from that. I was thinking when you were talking about people doing onboarding process and stuff, I have a friend who, you know, trained to become an architect, and then in his first couple of years, I said, you know, how's it going? He said, well, you know, I've been designing a lot of door frames, you know, or guttering and things like that. It was just, you know, there was a lot of that before he got to do the kind of the big building or somewhere and things like that. But there's also, you know, it's a recognized, accredited discipline and trade and all that thing. But there's also this idea that if you don't do that stuff, people get hurt, right? Things go wrong. And I feel that's a thing that's really missing. Lou Down actually said this about services. They said that, you know, there's so many broken services. If these things were physical products, they would be recalled. You know, and as you said, these things are at the center of our lives, and they touch most people.
Well, right. And yeah, kind of shifting even from architecture to planning, essentially, right? Yeah. How do we get cars off streets and create spaces for more other forms of transit and travel? How do we, in the United States, how do we, and this seems to be true all over the world, but how do we build housing and enable folks? It's not just single family homes. How do we discourage suburbanism or suburbanization and all that kind of stuff? It's in the design of those, of that planning practice. That I think little things will end up having these outsized impacts.
Very good. Stuart Brand, I'm grateful that my son is a good one for that too, actually.
But, my 15-year-old son a few months ago came to me and said, I think I want to be an urban planner. And I asked him, what? How? Why? And he's what had happened is he'd gotten new urbanist pilled by YouTube. You know, we're all afraid that our kids are going to go down these weird alt-right rabbit holes, and instead my kid is watching Not Just Bikes and City Beautiful and now wants to, you know, remake the world, you know, car-free, appropriate density, 15-minute cities, all that kind of stuff. So I actually feel good about that.
Yeah, that's pretty hopeful. That's nice to hear. Hey, where can people find you online? You're at Peter Mayer. I say your name, Jim.
At PeterMayerHolz.com. Yeah. That's my professional website. I semi-regularly post my thinking there, articles, blog posts, that kind of stuff around leadership and organization design. And then the other place that I hang out a lot is LinkedIn, just my name, Peter Mayerholtz. You can follow me there. More thoughts. I also teach classes and I have my own podcast. And so all the announcements for those kinds of things are always shared on LinkedIn.
People find, you're on Mastodon, aren't you?
I am on Mastodon. I don't use that in any serious business way. That's become this little kind of Twitter replacement for like silliness and memes and, you know, this thing I saw recently.
I really like it. It reminds me of Twitter in the very early days.
Yeah,
you know,
it's kind of low key, low heat.
Yeah,
it's much more water cooler. Fine by me.
Chat. Yeah. I like it. It gives me. I feel a bit more.
There, I'm Peter Me at SFBA Social, SFBA San Francisco Bay Area dot social.
Ah, is that what it stands for? I can't wonder.
Yes.
Thank you so much for being my guest on Power of 10.
My pleasure, Andy. Thank you for having me.
You have been watching and listening to, in fact, Power of 10. You can find more about the show on Palaine.com, where you'll find you can find my leadership coaching practice, online courses, newsletter, doctor's note. If you have any thoughts, you can put them in the comments on YouTube, or just get in touch. You'll find me as I'm A Palaine, APOLAINE, on pkm.social on Mastodon. And we'll put all the links in the show notes. Thanks for listening and watching, and I'll see you next time.